To recap where we have been, the three children who are not Edmund have been with the beavers, have escaped, and are on their way to meet Aslan. The magic of the witch has been broken, and Always Winter, Never Christmas is being reversed in front of them, like, you know, this in fast forward. They meet Father Christmas, who, after being kept out of Narnia for a long time, is finally here, and he offers gifts. Gifts to the beavers and gifts to the three children. These gifts are not toys, they are
the tools.
They're tools. He says these are not toys, these are tools. Who else gives us gifts that are not toys, but are tools?
Right?
The gifts of the Holy Spirit, are they something to play with, or are they something to use?
Yeah.
So, and they are now watching this wintry, frozen, deathly landscape transform into a beautiful springtime woodland in front of their eyes. Edmund, on the other hand, has had the worst of it, where the witch has been dragging him along in her sled, which is having a worse and worse time traveling because there's less and less snow until finally there's nothing, and they just have to walk. She and the dwarf are being miserable to Edmund, and he is miserable, and there is this threat of imminent punishment at any time, that she is so angry that her spell is being broken that she's liable to take it out on them in any moment. Mm-hmm. They come across an adorable little woodland scene of these animals celebrating a Christmas feast offered by Father Christmas, and the witch turns into stone. And for the first time, something in Edmund changes. And it's a pity, but it's the truth, that it takes something living to turn to stone, to take something inside of Edmund that was stone, to be brought back to life. That is from, which prophet is that? Is that Ezekiel or is it Joel who says, "You've taken my heart of stone and you have given me a heart of flesh"? But this is this promise that we rely on God for, the coldness of our lives, the hardness of our hearts, and He is the one who can breathe life into the dry bones and make them live. He is the one who can take our heart of stone and give us a heart of human beating flesh again. He is the one who can bring the blind and give them sight. He is the one who can bring the dead and give them life. And so that will lead us then to chapter 12. So the beginning on chapter 12 helps set the scene. What are things like now? In the very beginning.
Party time.
They're still traveling at the beginning of chapter 12, but what has that journey turned into?
It's amazement.
Well, it's, they're enjoying the beauty and the smells.
It's turned into a beautiful hike. Rather than a frantic march,
right.
You know, they were escaping before. They were trying to be quick. They were trying to be secretive. They were trying to hide. They were anxious and fearful. And now all of a sudden,
it's warming.
Hey,
the witch can't get there so fast, and so we don't have to be in such a hurry. And they were tired, and they just
enjoy
all the glory around them.
And they're away from the river now because of the fog.
Now the river is a real river.
Mm-hmm.
They're worn out, but it's not that... you ever had one of those days where you're just exhausted by the end of it, even though you can't remember what you've done? But the day itself has been stressful, and the stress takes a physical toll on you?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's a different kind of tired than when you've had a productive day, maybe gardening or exercising or doing something really positive where your body's been in motion, you get to the end of the day, and it's kind of like an earned tiredness.
Yeah. Yeah.
And one's sort of different than the other.
Very yeah. much so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They're tired, but I think it's the good tired.
Yeah.
It's mentally. It's kind of a nice, you know, it's the sort of fatigue where you feel like you've earned it well. Not a burdensome tired, but more like a, whew, we made it. All right, so they have reached the place of the stone table. They go past it, and there's an opening in the forest now, and what do they see?
They see the sea. They realize
they
that.
See the sea.
Yeah.
The sea.
It's open in every direction except for the east, where they see the sparkling, beautiful sea. Mm-hmm. Where have we heard the sea mentioned before? In this book, we've heard the sea mentioned, I think, only one time before, and it was not specifically. It was connected to something else. There has been a reference to the emperor.
Oh,
the emperor
beyond
the sea. I think that's the only time the sea has been mentioned. But now, as things open up, what do they get a glimpse of? The sea. And so,
also they see the pavilion.
This wide open glade has a pavilion. And who's at the pavilion?
Aslan
is there. Aslan the lion is there. And there's all sorts of creatures and animals. What kind of creatures and animals?
Half men, half horse, whatever they're called.
Okay. So we've got a couple of centaurs there. We've got naiads and dryads. These are
what are naiads and dryads?
I was going to look at it.
So naiads and dryads, and he kind of explains it. But if you're not familiar with some of these Greek mythologies, he calls the dryads tree women and the naiads well women. So basically, a spirit of the woods and a spirit of the water.
Fairies.
Well, yeah, I think fairies, like a fairy associated with a tree versus a fairy associated with a river. Mm-hmm. Naiads and dryads. The dryads, dry trees. Naiads, for the water. For yeah, but these are like some kind of fairy like creatures associated with the forest. The
fauns.
Well, yeah, fauns, but more in the sense of the spirit of the tree itself. If that tree actually has a pixie-like spirit within it, that would be the dryad. If that river actually has a spirit within it, that would be the naiad, or down the well, or whatever. So again, these are making reference to some older mythologies where there would be a way for trees to speak and interact. There would be, you know, a river that you might have to cross, but it's going to ask you questions, or it's going to not want to let you cross, or, you know, whatever it is.
Or it's going to help you cross.
It's going to help you, or it's going to kill you. But anyway, naiads and dryads, these are natural spirits. These are spirits of nature.
There's a
unicorn. There's a unicorn.
There's a dog.
Two leopards.
I mean, there's all sorts of cool stuff here.
And a dog.
So, there at the pavilion, we see Aslan himself, and there is a description given of Aslan. And it says the children didn't know what to do or say when they saw him. People who have not been in Narnia sometimes think that a thing cannot be good and terrible at the same time. If the children ever thought so, they were cured of it now, for when they tried to look at Aslan's face, they just caught a glimpse of the golden mane and the great, royal, solemn, overwhelming eyes, and they found they couldn't look at him and went all trembly. So let's kind of consider that for a minute. Good and terrible. Mm-hmm. How can something be good and terrible?
It's kind of like what we're supposed to do as God. We fear God because mm-hmm. it's overpowering grace, and we would not be able to look at him in the face because it's so glorious. And
right.
And we have to fear him, but then again, we respect him and give love to him. So it's kind of like the same.
Well, he's a loving God, and but he's also, yeah.
Yeah, I think, you know, good is describing the essence, and terrible is that feeling that we have of being overwhelmed.
Yeah.
Trying to live up to what you think God wants.
Mm-hmm. This is a, it sounds on its face to be kind of counterintuitive or contraindicated to say good and terrible. But I think we are looking at, we're considering the nature of awe.
Yeah.
And
frightening.
Frightening, and I think rightly so. Not in a, because something is bad, but because it's just so much.
Yes.
Overwhelming.
It is overwhelming. It's hard to take in.
Possibly.
Grand Canyon, anybody ever been? I've been to the North Rim.
I'd love to go.
It's hard to describe how big it is. And by big, I don't necessarily mean deep.
The vastness of it.
It's the vastness of it. We did this whole trip when I was a teenager, and we did it, you know, all around the West. And there were canyons I liked more than the Grand Canyon. Bryce Canyon, Utah, for instance, I thought was spectacular. It was canyony with the jagged, rocky peaks with the beautiful colors, the oranges and the reds. And it was smaller in scope, but there was a rugged, deep beauty to it that I really loved. But then the Grand Canyon seemed a lot plainer. It was much more wooded, foresty. When I think of canyons and the, you know, yeehaw, the Southwest and cowboys and cactus and tumbleweeds, that was more Bryce Canyon. The Grand Canyon, a lot of it looked like just a forest, but it dropped, and it just went. As far as you could see in every direction, it just went. And you can get close to the edge and look down, and just your head just kind of spins a little bit, and you just sort of step back. So the beauty of it combined with your brain just trying to take in how enormous this thing is, and that you're actually steps away from death. I mean, if you had taken a couple of more steps, you would have fallen and not gotten back up. So that sense of awe. So we've already mentioned before when Aslan has come up about, you know, you would either have to be a fool or braver than most to stand in front of him without your knees knocking. So they've actually now it's reality to them. And so they're all there, and who goes up first?
Peter.
And how long does it take him to go up?
Ages.
Because they're all, you do it, no, you do it, no, you do it. And so they almost argue, because nobody wants to go up first. But finally Peter does, because Peter is responsible. He's the oldest boy. And he is responsible, so he goes up. So he kind of sort of doesn't know what to do. He pulls his sword and salutes, and, you know, we have come, Aslan. And how does Aslan greet them?
Welcome, Peter.
Warm.
Like they're old friends.
Yeah.
Like he was expecting them.
Like he was expecting them, and he refers to them each by name.
Yeah.
You are not generic sons of Adam and daughters of Eve. You are Peter, Susan, and Lucy.
And we're...
I know you. He calls us each by name. Peter doesn't even have a chance to introduce himself, and Aslan already knows. And he says the voice is deep and rich, and the fidgets just kind of went out of them. So actually hearing his voice, it soothed them like balm for their soul.
I like the part about Beaver She and Beaver He.
Yeah, He Beaver and She Beaver, yeah. So where is the fourth?
With the witch.
Yeah.
Okay, so Mr. Beaver says he's betrayed them, mm-hmm. and What does Peter say?
Says, I contributed.
Yes. Yeah. It was partly my fault. I was angry, and I think that was a part of why he left. And what's the response to this? It's a quiet moment, but it's an interesting one.
He doesn't respond in the sense that
never mind all that.
That's just not an ask to let it go.
You know, it's when we apologize to someone, or when we take responsibility for something, we sort of expect an immediate response. I'm sorry. And what do you say? That's okay. I mean, that's always a response, right? And I've talked about that before, about how easy that is, but you know, Christians ought to seek forgiveness and not just say sorry or make excuses or apologize. And I think in that moment, he speaks truthfully, but maybe wants it's okay. But he doesn't get it. Mm-hmm. He doesn't get it. Because he gets something else. And it just makes this kind of like there was nothing else to be. He looked in Aston's eyes, and Aston just sort of looked in for a little, and there's nothing more to be said. So he was just, you spoke truly. You are not condemned, but I'm also not going to say don't worry about it. It just, you have spoken the truth. And there is something, I think, very subtly profound about that. It's, you know, he's not going to be worried about it anymore, but it wasn't dismissed. And I think that is not unimportant, nor is it unlike the fact that, you know, Jesus takes our sins seriously. We don't stand condemned in front of him, but neither does he wave a magic wand and say, you know, it didn't happen.
Right.
It does happen, and there is a cost. It's a cost that he will pay for us. But it's not that it never happened. It's not that it's unimportant. It's that you are not to be burdened by it because you've been forgiven.
You're not to be burdened by it, but there is a consequence, and you have to correct that consequence.
Yes. Yes, and I think the story won't leave it by itself. And I think that part of the consequence is Peter has now sort of accepted his level of responsibility. I mean, he's an 11 or 12-year-old boy. I mean, and at the end of the day, you know, Edmund did what he did because of Edmund. But it's not for nothing that suddenly Peter had enough in him to actually say that out loud. And I think that's kind of both the reward and the consequence, that Peter was able to speak truly. And Aslan doesn't diminish it, but he also doesn't condemn him. Please, Aslan, can anything be done to save Edmund? And Aslan says, all shall be done, but it may be harder than you think. And Lucy notices something about his face. His face, which has been very grand and very royal and very, very powerful. And what else does she see in the face of Aslan?
Sadness.
There is a line, and it's actually from Lamentations, but it is often connected to Jesus as a messianic statement, and we say it during the Stations of the Cross, that he was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And for Jesus to be truly human, fully man, he has to know grief. That if God is unchangeable and above the sadness and the sorrow, Jesus in his humanity is not. Because if you don't feel any sorrow or sadness, what do we say about such a person? They're not human. They're not human. Like someone who is a psychopath. They feel no compassion. They feel no sympathy. They feel no sorrow or sadness. We say you're something less than human. There's something damaged and wrong about you that's actually very dangerous.
No conscience.
There's no conscience. There's something super important that's missing. Something essential that's missing. But it's not missing in Jesus. O daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me. Weep for yourselves and for your children. There's a sorrow and a sadness to Christ, and perhaps knowing the true state of ourselves and of the world. Joy, I think yes. Remember, there's a complaint given about I can't do right in some people's eyes when we played a song you didn't sing, and when we played a dirge you didn't mourn. So basically he's saying that, you know, people said Jesus is either too happy or he's too sad. So, but there's that gamut of human emotion. And shortest verse in the New Testament, at least English,
Jesus wept
at the grave of his friend. He was about to raise him from the dead. But before he raises Lazarus, he cries. So, there is sadness in the face of Aslan. But then it's gone. He claps his paws. I think it's kind of cute about terrible paws, thought Lucy, if he didn't know how to velvet them. I thought that was just kind of a sweet little
way. Used that way.
Yes. Well, it's kind of an English way to put it, mm-hmm. but it's like a cat's paws, mm-hmm. where they can have their claws retracted, right. and it's all soft and nice, as opposed to ready to scratch and tear. So there is to be a feast, and then Aslan wants to spend a moment alone with Peter. What does he do with Peter?
He tells him that he is one of the four humans that are to sit on the throne,
mm-hmm.
and he's the king,
because
yes. he's the eldest.
You will be the high king over the rest, but there in the distance, right on the shore of the sea, is Caer Paravel, this beautiful castle where you will rule Narnia from. And then something happens in this kind of majestic moment to sort of break the mood. What happens?
The witch comes.
Not before the witch.
There's
a bugle.
Yeah.
And what's the bugle actually in reality? It is Susan's horn.
Susan.
Oh,
right, yeah.
And what about Susan's horn did Father Christmas say?
To use it as a tool only in extreme emergency.
What will happen when the horn is blown?
All of the help will come.
And who's the help in this regard?
All of the animals of the forest.
Yeah. So everybody's going to go help, but who actually does the helping?
Peter
does. Aslan says, well, everybody back off.
Oh, that's right.
Back off. Let him earn his spurs. That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. What does that mean? Let the prince earn his spurs.
Become a man.
Become a man. That's exactly
Show
right.
Courage.
That's exactly right. To trust a leader who has actually fought versus a leader who is simply appointed and it really has no idea.
Doesn't a knight have a mask?
Yeah, a knight to earn your spurs as a knight means. Well, first of all, what are spurs for?
Urging on the horse.
Horses. If you don't have a horse, you have no need of spurs. So, who rides horses in this kind of quasi medieval sort of culture? Knights do. Okay, so the knight, squires and peasants and even soldiers don't ride horses. Knights ride horses. So knights, a symbol of your knighthood is earning your spurs, because now you have earned the right to ride a horse. And so how is Peter, what's the task given to him to earn his spurs?
Kill the wolf and save Susan.
Go save your sisters. a wolf has them cornered. Lucy's run off terrified, and Susan is up a tree. So what does Peter do?
Well, he didn't feel very brave.
Nope.
But he went anyway.
Because he saw that she was going to faint, and she would be
right.
And if Peter wasn't going to help, who would?
No one.
So that it was up to him.
Yeah.
And did he feel brave?
No.
Nope, but he did it anyway. So, do you recall anything about the description given of this brief little battle?
The sword at the wolf, but it misses at first.
Right. So the first thing he does is just sort of blunder because he doesn't know what he's doing. He's a 12-year-old boy. Has he been trained to be a swordsman? No.
Then he swings again and gets
killed. Well, look at the description again for a second.
That stroke never reached the wolf.
Right.
Quick as lightning, it turned around, its eyes flaming, its mouth wide open in a howl of anger.
Yes. It would have got it by the throat. And it happened too quickly for Peter to even think. He had just enough time to duck down and plunge his sword as hard as he could between the brute's forelegs into his heart. Came a horrible, confused moment, like something in a nightmare. He was tugging and pulling, and the wolf seemed neither alive nor dead, and his bare teeth knocked against his forehead, and everything was blood and heat and hair.
Duck.
There is an expectation sometimes that, you know, battles and fighting, and it's very adventurous, and it's very exciting, and this description isn't like that at all.
Don't you think those descriptions are man-made play toy descriptions? And this is more like what real war is.
Yeah.
I've never been in war, but I think about the men that go to war and what they must feel like when they see the enemy coming toward them. And they don't, I mean, they're just like them. They don't want to kill them, but it's either kill or be killed.
And then suddenly it's like something in a nightmare. Mm-hmm. And it's just heat and hair and blood and confusion. And he's exhausted at the end. And, you know, I might not have fought in a war. C.S. Lewis did. Mm-hmm. C.S. Lewis fought in World War I. And was wounded in World War I.
So he knew exactly.
And I think he is writing from personal experience. That it's not this, you know, magical, adventurous moment, but instead it's kind of like a nightmare, and he sort of just wants to throw up, but ultimately he does what he has to do.
Sort of like the difference between writing about something and participating.
Yeah, there's just a little bit of reality that sneaks into this fantasy work here, where this moment could have been like this, dun 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 dun, bum bum bum, Peter saved the day. But instead, he puts in this little moment where actually this is pretty awful. Remember what we talked about before about when Father Christmas gives the gifts, and he gives the gifts to the girls, and he says, you know, war is an ugly thing when women are involved. And some people take that as kind of sexism on C.S. Lewis's part. And I would say, sexism or not, there's a reality to it. That concept of total warfare, like when women are involved, when our children start fighting, you know, from home to home and from tree to tree, it's horrible. Very, very ugly. So it's not romanticized. The moment is not, you know, cleaned up to the point of unreality. There is this realism that I think comes from C.S. Lewis's very real personal experience.
That one little bit, its bared teeth knocked against its forehead, his forehead.
Yes.
And everything was blood and heat and hair.
Yeah, it's just sort of an awful moment.
Yeah.
But I think maybe this is coming from a place of real experience.
Mm-hmm.
So hooray, hooray, and good job, and what's kind of the end result of this moment and this chapter?
Kissing and crying on both sides.
Well, no, he's knighted by...
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. So the prince has indeed won his spurs. And the sword, which he didn't clean, so you better clean it.
Mm-hmm.
And so... he is knighted by Aslan. Well, what is his knight's name, by the way? It's kind of fun.
Peter Wolfsbane.
Sir Peter Wolfsbane.
Oh, yeah.
Wolfsbane is a plant.
Wolfsbane is a plant. That's right. That's right. And in this sense, you earned your knighthood through the death of the great wolf. And that will be your identifier. We actually find out somewhat sideways in the next chapter that this isn't just any wolf. Which wolf is this?
He's the boss.
This is the boss. This is the captain of the witch's secret police. This is the chief wolf. This isn't just a wolf or a soldier. This is like taking out one of her chief lieutenants. As the confusion dies down and right before the knighting and everything else, Aslan then sends off the fastest of the creatures, flying eagles and running leopards and all that kind of stuff, go see if now is the time to rescue Edmund. So we pick up in the next chapter with Edmund.
That last comment, wiping your sword, is there more to it?
You know what? I've wondered that for years, and I don't know. I partially wonder if it's either an in-joke with someone that we don't know,
okay,
or if maybe a little bit of the old soldier is coming out in him. You know, the same old soldier that could write that moment of hair and heat and darkness and confusion also had drilled in him that you keep your gun clean. Otherwise, it's going to jam, you're going to be in a spot. I don't know. Over the years, I've thought through many things, and I don't know. Maybe it has some really obvious meaning that I don't get, but anyway.
Just keeping your tools.
Maybe the stewardship of your gifts. Mm-hmm. Could be. Okay, so... we meet Edmund again, and he's there with the dwarf and the witch. And what are they about to do?
Kill Edmund.
Let's just kill him. Okay, there's four thrones. We don't have all four, but we have one. And if we kill one, then they don't have four.
They won't occupy it.
Four chairs. That's right.
Four thrones.
Now... what does the witch say to this plan? She says something very interesting, and it's worth making reference to, because I think it's one of those things that means more than it says.
It wouldn't fulfill the prophecy if they only had the three.
She said he may not stay long, referring to Aslan.
Okay, maybe. She's willing to do it, but she would have a preference. Where does she want to kill Edmund?
She wants
to kill Edmund on the stone table.
Yeah.
Why? She makes a statement here, and I think it's a meaningful one.
Something about that's where it's supposed to be.
That's where it's always been done before. It will be a long time now before the stone table can again be put to its proper use, said the dwarf. So we've passed by the stone table without too much discussion. They looked at the stone table in the last chapter, and it just looked like a very ancient
ruins,
kind of ancient ruins, and it's sort of table like, but there's something carved into it very deeply that looked like a foreign language or symbols they didn't understand, but it looked very, very, very old. Now, the witch has said that the proper place to kill someone like Edmund would be on the stone table.
That's where it's always going to be.
That's where it's always. What can we glean from this?
Well, somebody set the rules.
Okay, somebody set the rules.
That's where Abraham, his son.
Okay, all right, talking about the sacrifice of Isaac, okay.
What about the stone tablets, the Ten Commandments?
Okay, stone tablets, Ten Commandments. I think we so let's we're going to put a pin on this, we're going to get back to it. Because when we get a little deeper in, I think, but I wanted that connection to start here. All right, this is the proper place for the sacrifice. So let's keep on going. There's no time to make it to the stone table, besides that's where Aslan probably is. So, shucks, we can't do it there. What are we going to do?
Tie to a tree.
Got to do what you got to do. So Edmund is tied to a tree. His head is pulled back. He hears a sound that he realizes is a knife being sharpened. And his throat is about to be cut. When what happens?
The other wolf rushes up.
The other wolf rushes up and he explains to her what has happened. The captain has been killed, Aslan is there, and we gotta go. And what is her response?
No.
No. Instead.
Call all of my men.
It's time to fight. We will meet his army with our army. Call all the nasty, creepy, bad things and tell them that now is the time. What are some of the things that she's calling out?
All the ghouls.
Ghouls and boggles and ogres and minotaurs. The cruels, hags, specters, and the people of the toadstools.
They're the ones that Mr. Tumnus referred to in the beginning.
It's this kind of neat pulling out from creepy little legends and mythologies and all the kind of spooky, scary, bad, wicked things.
I've forgotten what a minotaur.
The Minotaur was in the center of the Minotaur was found in the center of the labyrinth, and he had the body of a man and the head of a bull, and he was the monster created to kill anyone who could make it through the maze of the labyrinth. This is in Greek mythology.
But wasn't there a man with the head of a bull in
that's a centaur.
There was a bull with the head of a man.
That was what it was in
the reverse Minotaur. Who knows?
You have one of those, right? Who knows?
Yeah. Okay. So
we have a Minotaur.
All right, so she is sending out the wolf to go rally her troops, and now she is about to kill Edmund. She bares those deadly white arms of hers, and right before she can do it, what happens?
He's taken.
He's forced to his feet and taken.
He is rescued. So that party that Aslan sent out, they make it just in the nick of time. One knocks the knife away, the other chases the dwarf, a couple more try to untie Edmund. Somehow in all the confusion, the witch and the dwarf escape.
Disappear.
She's got, she keeps her magic wand safe, and that allows them to be disguised as like a rock and a stump or something.
Yeah.
And anyway, Edmund is rescued. So these big, strong arms, and they take him back to his family and back to Edmund. Now, the kids wake up and find out the good news. This has happened maybe overnight or whatever it is. And they find out your brother has been rescued, but where is he? He's not with them. Who is he with?
Aslan.
And they can see him. They see them all by themselves, just the two of them, just talking. For a long time, just talking. And Aslan brings Edmund over to them and says, here's your brother. and there is no need to talk to him about what has passed. And he says, I'm sorry, and they say, that's all right. And it's a little bit awkward, but everybody wants things to be
good.
That this is okay. What did you take from this scene? Edmund and Aslan walking alone for a long time, Aslan bringing him back, Aslan giving him to his brothers and sisters to say, here is your brother, no need to go into the past. How does all that strike you?
It's kind of like if we were able to walk with Jesus and talk to him about our sins, and he would tell us that we were forgiven.
He said, and
just
those very close moments.
Yeah.
Yes, yes.
Absolution.
I think it is. And interestingly enough, Edmund's the worst kid, and yet he spends the longest and most intimate time with Aslan. Mm-hmm. The only other person who spent a quiet moment with Aslan has been Peter, but that didn't last long because it was interrupted. Right. But we get the impression that Aslan and Edmund were out there, just the two of them, for a long, long time.
It's a lot like life, isn't it?
I think
so. When it's good, we don't spend enough time with the Lord, and when it's not so good, we're there on our knees all the time.
You know, Edmund, who had done so much wrong, and been so selfish, and been so stupid, mean-spirited about it all, and yet he, like all of us, offered that intimacy, offered that absolution. He alone has that quiet time with Aslan all by himself. Very long, very extended. And then Aslan brings him back in. Edmund doesn't have to walk back and say, it's okay. I think there was something about Aslan saying, here is your brother. Mm-hmm. Does that strike anybody in a particular way?
It's like he's so proud of
his son.
Yeah.
I think this is an echo of the prodigal son. So, I've preached on this before, and the prodigal son, in general, I think is misnamed. It doesn't have a title. The title is put on after the fact. But it's in a series of parables, lost coin and that kind of stuff, where some lost sheep, something is found. And for the other parables that come before it, the central character is always referenced first. There was a woman who lost a coin. There was a shepherd who lost a sheep. So in the story that we call the prodigal son, you remember how it starts? There was a father who had two sons. So who's the star of the show? It's not the prodigal. It's the father. So we remember the prodigal. And he runs off, wastes his life, and he comes back, and the father greets him and restores him. And the reason why I say it's important to acknowledge that the father is the central character is because it doesn't end with the restoration of the prodigal son. There's more to come. What happens next? There's another brother who is ticked off. This other brother.
Hey, I've been the loyal.
I've always been here. Yeah. And you're.
What about me?
And there's a neat line about this that really underscores how angry and bitter he is. Where he act. This is what he says. That son of yours. It's like, you know, I know when my kids are in extra trouble when my wife says, your son did something or other. So the angry older brother says, that son of yours. And how does the father respond? Your brother.
Reminds him.
Was dead and now he is alive. Mm-hmm. So it is the father who not only reconciles the prodigal back to himself, but the brothers to one another. Mm-hmm. And so it's Aslan who says,
Here is your brother.
Yeah. Any grudge you have held, even rightly, because he really was a little stink pot and a traitor and everything else. But I bring him back to you not as a traitor. I bring him back to you as your brother. All right. Well, this would be a great place to stop, except the chapter keeps going. Who shows up next to ruin this nice scene?
A messenger from the witch.
A messenger from the witch. It is this little son of Earth, this little dwarf.
Oh, yeah.
And the queen wants to come speak, but she wants guarantee of safe passage. There's just a little bit of, you know, this kind of happens with the whole, you know, this is there's a parlay called, I guess, and there's a way that you're supposed to do this. There's a protocol to all this, right. Yeah. Right. And so, let's just jump into where the witch and Aslan meet. She's granted safe passage as long as she doesn't bring the wand, so that's what she does. And Aslan and the witch
parley
with everyone else around. How does that go? What does she want?
The deep magic.
She wants Edmund.
Edmund belongs to me.
Because he was a traitor.
He was a traitor.
Right. Yeah.
And why do traitors belong to her?
Because she turned a lot of things to stone.
Right.
Satan.
Okay. The law, which law says that the traitors belong to her?
What
does she say? She says the deep
magic.
The deep magic says that all traitors belong to me. And Aslan says, let's say that I've forgotten. What is the deep magic? And how does she explain it? Tell you what is written on the very table of stone which stands beside us. Tell you what is written in letters deep as a spear is long on the fire stones of the secret hill. Tell you what is engraved on the scepter of the emperor beyond the sea. You at least know the magic which the emperor put into Narnia at the very beginning. You know that every traitor belongs to me as my lawful prey, and that for every treachery, I have a right to kill. And while everyone's Aslan, does he dispute her or disagree?
No.
He says, you're right. You're right.
And then the witch
says that he knows. Aslan knows that if he doesn't give me my due rights, all of Narnia will be undone in fire and water. The deep magic that binds Narnia together and preserves it will be broken if you break it by not giving me my traitor.
But we don't know who set the rules.
Now, can we take a guess based off of what she just said? Who set the rules of the deep magic? Where the deep magic is inscribed on the stone table, where else is it inscribed?
The emperor of the sea.
On the scepter, the symbol of authority, on the emperor beyond the sea. So the deep magic, these are the rules of the emperor beyond the sea. The deep magic are the rules at the creation of Narnia. This is in essence the natural law. This is also the Mosaic law. It's written in creation, and it's written in tablets of stone. The stone table, I will argue, is the representation of the law. And the law, the Mosaic law, how do you atone for sin in the Mosaic law?
Sacrifice.
Sacrifice in the altar, sacrifice in the temple. They're, you know, sacrificing birds, sacrificing bulls, sacrificing lambs and sheep, and this whole system of sacrifice and blood. And I think the stone table, based off of its description, the deep magic inscribed in it, based off of what they say about that's where, you know, a traitor ought to be killed, that's where blood ought to be shed. I think it's the temple, it's the law, it's the Ten Commandments, it's the natural law, it's all wrapped up together. And is Aslan going to deny the deep magic?
Susan wants it.
No.
He says no.
Should he break the deep magic? What would happen if he did?
Well, supposedly the water and fire would destroy the world.
Yeah.
But not,
well, can't Aslan fight against the deep magic?
Probably he can.
Right. What does he do? They actually say that. Work against the emperor's magic. What does he do?
He
He turns to her with something like a frown on his face, just by the suggestion, and nobody says it again. So there's this beautiful moment. You know, the queen has stated, and stated rightly, unless I have blood, the law says all of Narnia will be destroyed in fire and in water. And she wants Edmund's blood, and he's right there.
He says...
So what is Edmund doing this whole time? They're talking about him. They're talking about his life and his death.
Look at his shaking.
And all he can do, and all he does do, is he just looks at us. Mm-hmm. They are arguing over my death, and I will simply look at you. And it's this beautiful little moment.
Yeah.
This beautiful little moment. You know, this is like a... You know, we've already caught a lot of the metaphors here. I mean, imagine the, you know, Jesus and Satan arguing over a soul. And what does that soul do other than just stare in the face of Christ?
There's a song that has that line in it. And look forward
to Jesus.
So in this moment of greatest anxiety, what happens?
Aslan calls the witch. He wants to talk to her.
We're going to talk alone privately.
Surprised that she would even do that.
So off they go. And it's just, it's so quiet. And it's so, it's like everyone's even afraid to breathe. They talk about hearing bumblebees flying, that it's so silent. And then finally, Aslan calls them back. Mm-hmm. And what does he say?
He said, well, then she has renounced the claim.
She has renounced the claim. I cannot take it from her, not in abide by the deep magic, but she herself, who is owed the blood of the traitor, she herself has renounced her claim on Edmund. The matter is now settled. How does a witch look in all this? Defeated?
Make sure the
she looks like the big winner.
Yeah. A look of fierce joy and
triumph.
But the last moment she says, but how do I know you're going to keep your promises? And what's the response of Aslan?
Oh, yes, he does.
Ah! So,
we can count on
that. Yeah, the lion, for the first time, roars. And it's and why is he roaring?
To say, silence, I have under control.
But in response to what? There's been a suggestion made.
How dare you question?
Yes. To even suggest that Aslan wouldn't keep his promise. Just get out. And she turns her tail and she runs for her life.
And she should.
This is a great place to stop. We have had the matter settled, but we don't know how. It's a great mystery, but the witch seems happy. And Aslan says it's all been taken care of. She has renounced her claim.
Sad look in his eye.
Wonder what the promise is.
And so we will have to wait until next time for our next two chapters. That will be 14 and 15. Mm-hmm. And we'll do it again in 2 weeks after Thanksgiving. But worry not.
Got it.
2 weeks.
Aslan is on the move.
A week after Thanksgiving.
That's right.
Yeah.